Poetry on the radio, poetry in and around the ACT. Today, we continue a long conversation with multi-genre writer Subhash Jireth, plus the Rhyming Bugle, poetry news and events from the Canberra region. For ArtSound FM Community Radio, I'm Peter Searles. Our guest today on Poetry on the Radio, as last week and next, is Subhash Jireth, one of the most accomplished writers ever to work in the ACT. He has published in many forms, often reinventing the forms he ostensibly writes in. His collection of essays, Spinoza's Overcoat, Travels with Writers and Poets, from Transit Lounge Press, won the 2021 ACT Book of the Year. He followed it with another collection of essays, Always Learned, Fascinating and Inventive, George Orwell's Elephant and Other Essays, Gazebo Books 2023. His most recent book of verse is Aflame, Gazebo Books 2021. In 2020, Recent Work Press published his book of translations from Hindi, Rain Clouds, Love Songs of Mirabai. He has published books of poems in Hindi, English and Russian, as well as prose fiction and non-fiction. In some ways, Subhash Jireth's writing reflects his biography. He was born in Punjab, India, and spent 9 years studying geology and literature in Russia before migrating to Australia in 1986. When he came to the ArtSound studios towards the end of 2024, our conversation ranged widely over his thoughts and practices relating to writing. As today's episode begins, Peter Monahan summarizes some of what Subhash Jireth told us last week.
You spoke about the dissolving of the genre boundaries and what purpose you have in pursuing that, but your work certainly has tendencies that all intersect in a very productive way. You're clearly very interested in cultural geography and history as part of that, the nature of language, and at the same time you acknowledge the uncertainty of language. You seek to be very precise, and I've noticed even in what you read, it was somebody else's poem, but your use of words is both simple but very evocative and subtle. So you're clearly seeking to make language less uncertain at the same time as you embrace the uncertainties too, I think, and it all sort of meets in some kind of metaphysical dimension where there is a resonance, there's a meaning that resonates somehow through what you write. There seem to be all those dimensions at play at the same time in a purposeful way. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely. That's the whole beauty of it. It's like fishing. You go to fish. I think people, fishermen whose livelihood is fishing, naturally they want to catch the fish to make money. But one purpose of fishing is just to fish, knowing that whatever you'll catch will never satisfy you. That's the whole. The words are like fishnet. We put the fishnet in the world to capture some essence of the world, and which is an illusion. The world has no essence, or whatever essence is very fleeting. You will never catch it. And it's not only true with people who work with words or languages. It's also true with photographers, painters, artists, musicians, sculptors. It's always like that. It is always like that. With language, something strange happened. And I write about this in an essay about the loss of indigenous languages. And I coined a word, glossotalgia, like nostalgia. Glossotalgia is the grief I feel for the loss of languages. Because language is the home of being, as Heidegger used to say. We live in the house of languages. Now, in that essay, I talk about the famous story which comes from Plato's dialogues in Socrates, and which Derrida, the French philosopher, talks about again, the invention of writing. And when one of the ministers, intellectual, brought his invention to the pharaoh, Egyptian pharaoh, that this is one invention, and the pharaoh said, I don't have any use for it. It means loss of memory. Nobody will try to remember things. People will start relying on the written word and forget things. So it's a poison you have invented. And Derrida plays on the word pharmakon. As he deconstructs that word, which is a medicine as well as a poison. It's both. It works as both. So what has happened with that writing, invention of writing? Lots of oral literature or literature in various languages has been preserved. But what has been lost is the spokenness of the word. And Derrida says, and lots of people believe that spoken word, when uttered by a human being, has truth in it because it comes from the mouth, from the inside, from the soul. So he said, one gives this primacy to the oral word. But I don't think there is such a problem with that, especially with reading, with poetry. When I talked about the soundscape, what I am talking about is the word, the orality of the word. I can give you so many examples that there are certain human emotions and feelings and even thought that can't be captured by the written word. Now, I'm reading Farsi. The biggest problem I am facing there in reading Farsi now is it has unwritten vowels. Vowels are written for learners when they want to learn. Once they get used to it, there is no need. But because I am a beginner, I feel lost because I don't know how to join the consonants. So that's the problem. All languages which I know or which I have read, that's the problem. And this Nask or Nastaliq script, which Persians adopted for writing Farsi, is different from Arabic script. Because they realize that the Arabic script can't capture the sound, all sounds of Farsi. So they changed the script. And that's the whole purpose. All languages do that. The written word, as we read it in a book, printed word, can never capture the thought, intensity of emotions of the spoken word.
Our guest today on Poetry on the Radio is Subhash Jyareth.
One practice that you commonly have is to write biographies that may be autobiographies that are imagined, recreated using the data that you have, historical data, your own imagining of a person, of yourself even, I suppose, because you know what is uncertain in language would also be uncertain in memory, and remembering is an act of bringing things into being again or for the first time. So again, there's something sort of metaphysical about all of those dimensions, and yet they seem to be ones you grapple with over time.
Yeah, absolutely. Memory is a very, very tricky beast. Mm. So it's all. And in Spinoza's Overcoat, there are essays written from the voice of a narrator. I have created the narrator. It is equivalent to my voice. equivalent, not equal to. So once it's on the page, it's different from me. So you can't, no reader can judge about my life, my biographical life as a person relying on the narrator's voice in the essays. They are different. Because I am creating the narrator, once it's created, it's the voice is independent. Mm-hmm. It's slightly, they are like tangents, they come together and they move away. The essay on Ceylon in Spinoza's Overcoat is written in the fictionalized voice of Paul Celan himself. And in order to write that, in order to capture that voice, Celan's voice, I read two biographies, his diaries, and lots of translations of his poems. And that's what I tried to become Ceylon. I tried to perform the role of Ceylon, right? So that's why we do it, or most writers do it. And then there is an essay about Pasternak's famous poem, Hamlet, which comes in the novel Dr. Zhivago. And that essay is written in the voice of the poem itself. So it's sort of an autobiography of the poem. The poem is telling the story of its beginning and its creation. And the first line is, I have two fathers. And then say, no, one father and one stepfather. Pasternak is my father, and Dr. Zhivago is my stepfather. And then again change. No, this is not right. Pasternak is my father, and Dr. Zhivago is my... Pasternak is my grandfather, and Dr. Zhivago is my father. And then it tells the story of how the novel was written, Dr. Zhivago, and how the poem came into being. And it came into being at a very difficult time in the life of Boris Pasternak. And at that time he was working because he was not getting many commissions from the publishing authorities in the Soviet Union. The way for him to make a livelihood was translation. So he translated Shakespeare. He translated all the major plays of Shakespeare. And one of them was Hamlet. And Russians, and I have seen the play in Russia, in Moscow, often went to see those plays not because it was written by Shakespeare, but it was translated by Pasternak. And it took him at least 6-7 years to translate Hamlet. He translated, and I tell the story there, he finished first translation and trashed it, put it in the dustbin, because he read it and said it doesn't work. The meter I have chosen doesn't capture the soundscape. And so he redid this whole translation. There was always a readily available translation done by a Russian writer way back, and it had been staged many times. So one of the theater directors told him, can you translate Hamlet for us? So he started working on that. So his first translation, after he read it, he found similar to the translation available, and he didn't like it. So that's the beauty of translation. So it's the story of how the novel was written, Dr. Zhivago, the story of the translation of Hamlet, and the story, how that poem appears as Dr. Zhivago's notebooks, is told in that essay. That's why these essays are very long. That's why.
Somewhere in the book you say you prefer the phrase imaginative writing instead of creative writing. And this would be, like, I think, a superb example of why. The layers that the imagination can create and attend to all simultaneously somehow is more than creative writing.
Absolutely. You are absolutely right, because everything is creative. Even when now we are talking here, our conversation is an act of creation. It's a creative act. And if you take this, the essay about Spinoza's overcoat, in fact, when you read it, you'll find out that there are three overcoats there. I tell the story of three overcoats. One is the overcoat of Spinoza himself, with a hole from a dagger in the back. One is the coat of Celan's father, who was in the concentration camp with Celan's mother. And Celan's mother wrote a letter to Paul Celan, that it's very cold and I wish I could give your father an overcoat.
Our guest today on Poetry on the Radio is Subhash Jyrath. Next, he spoke about his book Aflame, published in 2021 by Gazebo Books under its Life Before Man imprint. Its last poem, in several sections, evokes a monk's self-immolation in response to Chinese soldiers killing his mother.
The last part, when you're talking about soundscape, that whole section has an utter life of its own. You bring this whole thing of language to life. It's almost more than a poem. I feel like it was an incantation in a way, but because of the subject matter, because it's about the monk, it creates this tension that has this power.
Yeah, Aflame, the last narrative in the book, Aflame, I first wanted to write a novel, tell the story of a young Buddhist monk who burns himself in the street as a protest against Chinese occupation. And I wrote a few thousand words. Then I thought, it's not working. The narrative, the story or the novel is not able to capture the emotion. If you'll gather three poets and ask them, what is a poem or what is poetry? You'll get 9 answers, or perhaps more. The thing is, no definition ever fits to poetry or to anything else. Every definition has exceptions. The best thing I ever found, which comes closest to what a poetic word is by Osip Mandelstam. In his essay on Conversations with Dante, he writes that poetic word is a word which rouses you, which shakes you awake in the middle of the word. Because it has got emotions. So I wanted to write something which can capture the emotion, not only the content, the story. Story is very clear. Oh, the Buddhist monk came out in the street, poured diesel on him and set himself alight. The story is very simple. Mm. The idea is not to convey that. No piece of art can be reduced to the message. And that's what Mandelstam says. If you want to paraphrase a poem, it's like bed where, or the sheet of a bed where love was not consummated, not fulfilled. So that's why the story doesn't, so that's why I wrote. And inspiration was Paul Celan. Paul Celan had this dilemma that should I write poetry in German, the language of the people who killed? But then he wrote, no, this is the language which my mother taught me, encouraged me to read and write, and I know that language. I'll write it in German, but I'll break that language by my own techniques. And that's what he did. When you read Celan's poem, his famous poem, The Death Fugue, it's so shattering. It's like what Mandelstam says, The Death Fugue. It starts like this, I think. The black milk of dawn, we drink it at dusk. We drink it at noon. In the morning we drink it. At night we drink and we drink. And so this drink word appears, and the black milk word appears. And black milk, when I read that poem, even in German, hits you. It's like the same with Lorca's poem about which I write. The line is, in translation, just shook me. And the line is beautiful. I sleep, I want to sleep, the sleep of apples. I read again, I want to sleep, the sleep of apples. And said, what Sloka is talking about? Why does he want to sleep the sleep of apples? And the whole essay is about what does that poem mean, that 6,000 words, just to explore how the poem came into being. So that's what the poem sort of shatters you, shakes you up. That's what it is. So that's why I couldn't emulate or copy Celan. It's impossible. Celan is Celan. But I just try to use that same technique of repetitions in complete sentences because language breaks.
Another dimension of that last section is the sense that history just happens, and humans, they are part of the history, but it's going to happen anyway. And I think you take that perspective elsewhere. Life keeps going in this strange way that both entails but ignores human individuality almost.
Yeah, not so much history, absolutely right. I mean, the main thing is violence. I explore this in A Flame. Violence always breeds violence. Mm-hmm. And in George Orwell's Elephant, in the first essay, begins with the question, and I ask it imaginatively to Orwell, did you shoot the elephant? And his answer is, perhaps. And it's an imagined answer. And I say, oh, why does he say perhaps? Perhaps he didn't shoot it. So did he shoot the elephant? It doesn't matter whether he shot the elephant or not, because that essay, 4 pages essay, is marvelous. Mm-hmm. It's a wonderful essay. But then I add in it a section from Indian book, Mahabharata. It is called Bhagavad Gita. And it's the story of war between two clans, where when the war begins, the prince of one of the clans, brothers, wants to ask his charioteer, I want to come out of the chariot and I want to walk in front of my enemies who are lined up against me. And so he starts walking. And he finds the other side, they are all his cousins. They're teachers. They're friends, friends of friends. He comes back, he says to his charioteer, I can't kill them. I don't want to fight. I give up. And he throws all his weapons. He says, I don't want to fight. Charioteer, and his so-called incarnation of a Hindu god, his purpose is to reason with him that he should fight. And I list, and that's why I call Bhagavad Gita a dangerous book. He gives five reasons why he should fight. And one of the reasons is expressed by a Sanskrit word, nimitta matram, the English translation of which will be instrument. The final reason he says is, you are my instrument. I am the one who is killing them. You are just my instrument. You are not killing them. You are just following orders. See, how many times people have used this word? Nazis, Stalin's killers. Oh, we were following orders. We didn't kill. So George Orwell didn't shoot the elephant. He pulled the trigger. That's right. But he killed it. And he says in this, I killed it because they were, and these are his words, there were thousands of yellow faces looking at me. They made me kill it. I didn't kill the elephant. So that's what it is, the nature of violence. And that's where the Buddhist monk who burnt himself, he didn't want to take a gun and fight against the Chinese. He didn't. He refuses. His friend bought the gun and wanted to give him the gun. He refused it. What's the purpose? Because by killing them, I'll kill myself.
We're out of time today, but come back next week to hear Subhash Jairath read three sections from this poem from his volume Aflame. For Poetry on the Radio, I'm Peter Searles.
The Rhyming Bugle. At Smith's Alternative in Civic on February 10 at 7 p.m. That Poetry Thing launches Alex Eagleton's latest collection, Taro. The Manning Clark Poetry Series takes place on the fourth Thursday of each month, and the Centre, which is in Forest, has announced some of its readings for 2025. On March 27, Hazel Hall and Deborah Dawkins, and on April 24, Christopher Kellen. Often poets mentioned in the Rhyming Bugle have been featured on past episodes of Poetry on the Radio. Listen back at artsound.fm. Pull down under the Programs tab for Poetry on the Radio. Poetry on the Radio is produced weekly on unceded traditional land in the studios of Artsound FM and airs Sundays at 4:30 p.m. and again at 10:30 p.m. on Mondays and online at artsound.fm. Series hosts are Kimberly K. Williams and Peter Searles, who produced the program with Peter Monahan. Find out more on the Poetry on the Radio page under the Programs tab at artsound.fm. Our theme is an imagining of an ancient Greek hymn to the muse Calliope by Gregoria Paniagua and the Atrium Musica de Madrid.